So yesterday we started discussing general relativity, EP, finally. So anyway, so the approach we take is the Hilbert's approach. So I want to formulate always the action principle and then see what the corresponding physics comes to be. So we started discussing particle in curved space, and then we may be asking, you know, and the action there is just an action of over the proper time, d of tau. But now you write it in terms of the curved metric. But otherwise, everything is the same. And we recover the geodesic equation. We can now generalize this and ask what happens with an arbitrary matter. So now matter would be described by the field theory. And so the corresponding action is simply an invariant volume integral over the corresponding Lagrangian density. And the Lagrangian density depends on our field phi and its covariant derivative. And of course, in that action, we also have to replace everywhere the flat metric with the curved one. So this action, this Lagrangian density, typically depends on the metric. It does not depend on the derivatives of the metric. If it does, then the Einstein equations actually are more complicated than you are used to them. Okay, so the assumption, silent assumption, is that only the metric here enters the Lagrangian density, not its covariant or you know, higher derivatives. All right. So we have the variation of this action, and if you vary this action with respect to the fields, or you can symbolically write it like that. But now we can integrate by parts, and simply you recover this beautiful expression here. Plus some boundary term, which you throw away because you say that the fields are fixed on the boundary of the spacetime. And then, of course, imposing that the action is stationary, you get these beautiful field equations, which are precisely the same equations as you would get in special relativity. The only difference is that now you replace the partial derivatives here with the covariant ones. Okay, so that's the field equations for the matter, and that's how the matter moves in the presence of gravity. So easy peasy. So now we can also, however, do a strange thing. We can take this matter action and we can vary it with respect to the metric. Okay, and so of course there will be in the end a variation of the metric. I have to make the whole thing a scalar, so there will be a tensor T mu nu there, so that the whole thing is a scalar. This minus 1/2 is just a definition, so I just take minus 1/2 out of this, and so this I will call an energy momentum tensor. And so this is a definition of some tensor T mu nu, but what is obvious that this tensor is symmetric in mu and nu because the antisymmetric part does not contribute here. So I can make it, without loss of generality, I can make it symmetric. But what really makes you to convince that this is something which you should call energy momentum tensor is the following statement. So if these field equations are satisfied, and what I'm also silently assuming here is that the action for the matter is diffeomorphism invariant. So really, we know that this is a scalar. So what we are assuming that this guy is a scalar as well. Okay, so that's basically true for any field theory you can write down, but that's a silent assumption which we are using here. So anyway, so if the field equations are satisfied and the action is diffeomorphism invariant, I can do coordinate transformations and it doesn't change, then actually this object defined over here will be covariantly conserved. And so that's called conservation of T mu nu. What that means, well, something is conserved, but is it really something conserved? We will discuss that today and tomorrow, what this equation really means. And there is a surprise waiting for you here. Okay, I will not spoil it. All right, so that's our equation, and that's why we call this object really an energy momentum tensor. So now, this is the energy momentum tensor due to Rosenfeld, but there are 101 other energy momentum tensors in theoretical physics. So we have already seen one in the front-end course, which was the canonical energy momentum tensor, which you derived through the Noether's procedure. So for example, you had a Poincaré invariant field theory, and then so in particular, the Lagrangian, or whatever, the action was invariant under space-time translations, And due to this invariance, we could use the Noether's theorem, and we could derive some energy momentum tensor that would be the canonical one. So sometimes this object is the same as the canonical one. Sometimes it is not. So for example, for the electromagnetic field, this object is the nice energy momentum tensor of the electromagnetic field, which is automatically symmetric and automatically gauge invariant. We have seen that the canonical one need not be. Okay, so this is better. And moreover, this is precisely the T mu which will couple to gravity. Okay, so now why is this true? So why nabla mu T mu equals to zero? So proof of this. And so we are basically using now the second Noether's theorem, saying if there is a local gauge symmetry, there will be something like a Bianchi identity. This is something like a Bianchi identity for this thing here. Okay, so how it goes is that we know that the action, so S matter, is invariant under coordinate transformations or diffeomorphisms. Okay, so that's what we know. So now the question is, so what is a diffeomorphism? Is that I change my coordinates x mu to some new x mu prime, but I can infinitesimally write it as x mu minus psi mu, where this is a small quantity. And so this is my new x prime, it's just x mu minus psi mu, where I treat this thing here as a small thing. Okay, you can think about psi mu as a vector field, and so I'm basically shifting my coordinates along some vector field, and that's the change of the coordinates. That's my x mu prime. Okay, so now, of course, under the change of this diffeomorphism, my fields will change slightly. So this induces the change in fields, some delta phi generated by this psi here. And it also induces the change of the metric. Okay, so the components of the metric will change as well. And we actually know how they will change. I'll tell you the secret today, but you will derive it next week in the tutorial. Okay, so the change of the components of the metric, so if I change coordinates from x mu to x mu minus psi mu, what you should find is that the components of the metric change as follows. So it's a Lie derivative of the metric g mu nu, but it's simply given by 2 times nabla mu psi nu. Okay, so it's nabla mu psi nu plus nabla nu psi mu. Okay, so this is how my metric changes under a diffeomorphism.
Sorry, what? You have brackets.
Yeah, I have these brackets, which is the symmetrization. So it's 1/2 of nabla mu psi nu plus nabla nu psi mu, but I have 2 times, so. Okay, so that's how the metric changes. And that's basically all I need to know. Of course, if phi is a scalar, well, then delta phi will be equal to zero. Okay, depends what you do. But anyway, so there can be some change in the phi in the fields, and there is a change in the metric. All right, and so this is all we need to know. So now we use the fact that the action is invariant under the change of coordinates. What it means is that I have the variation of the whole action, because I'm just doing a diffeomorphism, I'm just doing a coordinate transformation, is zero. Okay, but I can write it as 2 terms. I write it as a variation of the action with respect to phi times delta phi plus variation of the action with respect to g mu nu and delta g mu nu. Okay, so that's my 2 terms I'm writing down. Okay, very good. But what is the assumption which we are making in this statement. We are making an assumption that the field equations are satisfied, right? But what does it mean? So if the field equations are satisfied, it means this thing here actually is zero up to the boundary, term. Okay, so this will be zero due to the field equations are satisfied. So field equations are satisfied. So the first term does not contribute because this is precisely what I was doing here when I was deriving the equations of motion. So I was setting this equal to zero. All right, so now this simplified. But I know how my variation of the metric looks like because it's just induced by the coordinate transformation. So this is equal to, so it's an integral, delta Sm over delta G mu nu, delta S matter delta G mu nu, delta G mu nu. But if you look at that, what we are doing is that now, generally, we are just doing a variation of the matter action with respect to the metric. So now I can use this definition of the T mu nu. Okay, so now this is equal to minus 1 half integral d4 of x square root of g t mu nu delta g mu nu. Okay, so that's by definition. But I know what delta g mu nu is because it's just given here. So this is equal to, so there's 2 here which cancels that minus 1 half. That's minus d4 of x square root of minus g t mu nu nabla mu psi nu symmetrized. Okay, because that's how my delta g mu nu looks like. It's induced by the coordinate change. All right, but this is great. I know that T mu nu is symmetric, so I don't need a symmetrization here. The anti-symmetric part does not contribute. So I can delete the brackets. This will still be true because T mu nu is symmetric automatically. Okay, so the last step is that I want to integrate by parts. Okay, so I want to integrate by parts by shifting this derivative onto here. So by parts, okay, and so what we are getting is that this is equal to d4 of x square root of minus g nabla mu t mu nu and psi nu. Psi nu. I swapped the O. It doesn't matter. I can. This is fine. All right, so this is by parts, and then I have plus a boundary term, if you want. But you can always make the boundary term to vanish. And so you see that this has to be equal to zero. But it's zero for any coordinate transformation. That means for any psi nu. So you have to conclude that this thing is actually equal to zero. And that's the proof. So isn't that super nice? Is that all we are doing is that we are just using the fact that the action is actually coordinate invariant. I can do any coordinate transformations. I can do any diffeomorphism. And the field equations are satisfied, which kills this first term here. But then everything here is just using how the metric transforms in this way. So such T mu nu will be conserved. But you see immediately that actually I can sort of go the other way around as well. So actually, if nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero, so if this is zero, then I can go here. I know that the whole thing is equal to zero. So better delta Sm over delta phi better be equal to zero as well. So then this sort of implies maybe that delta Sm over delta phi is equal to zero, which would be the field equations. So now there was a huge debate, which lasted 50 years, and it's still not completely concluded. But basically, the people believe that there is an equivalence. So if the T mu is conserved, the equations of motion are satisfied. If the equations of motion are satisfied, the T mu is conserved. So maybe there is this equivalence here. And so what it would really mean is that that this equation, which people call completely misleadingly a conservation of T mu nu, is nothing else than basically it captures the information about the field equations. So this is actually field equations. All right, so this is something like field equations. So I think that's the most correct statement to view this conservation of T mu nu as field equations. Certainly, it's not a conservation of energy or conservation or something like that, as we shall see probably tomorrow.
I don't get why there's a debate on it. Like, why does it automatically follow?
Okay, so the best is to demonstrate this on specific examples, right? So, for example, you can study this, what happens for electromagnetic field. So you take the T mu nu of the electromagnetic field, you calculate nabla mu T mu nu equal to zero, and you see what kind of equations you can get out of that. And you will see that you almost get Maxwell equations, provided that the field is not algebraically special, meaning that it's not an electromagnetic wave. So if F mu nu, the invariant E square minus B square equals to zero, then you cannot conclude that the Maxwell equations are satisfied. So you need non-algebraically special solutions. So you need a little bit more than actually just the conservation of T mu nu. You need that the solution is not degenerate in some sense. Okay? So then there is an equivalence. But I think it's, you know, it's good to think about this, that it's more or less equivalent. That nabla mu T mu nu is something like a field equation. We shall see an example in a minute. All right, so we have this general theory. Are there any questions? If not, let's have a few examples. So example one is just the scalar field. It's just a scalar field, so the corresponding Lagrangian density. So if I specify what my Lagrangian density is, then I should know everything about the theory. So it's a minus 1/2 G mu nu, nabla mu phi, nabla nu phi, minus the potential, which can depend on phi. Traditionally, it would be m square phi square. So that's the corresponding Lagrangian density. Of course, if I am in flat space, then this just becomes eta mu nu, and people just write it as nabla phi square. So now notice that there's this annoying minus sign with respect to what you will probably see in the field theory course. That's because we are using different signature of the metric. We are using minus, plus, plus, plus. Then you have a minus here. If you were using plus, minus, 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 you would have a plus here. Okay? So anyway, so that's what the Lagrangian density is. So now let's see what the field equations are. So take this thing here and differentiate it with respect to phi. So the only thing which depends on phi is the potential V. Right, so this will just bring me dV over d phi, that term here. And then differentiate L with respect to the gradient of phi. Well, that will just give me another gradient of phi, this index up. And then I do another differentiation here. So I'll have box, covariant box on phi plus dV over d phi. Okay, so the Euler-Lagrange equations are simply written as nabla mu of phi minus dv over d phi equals to zero. Okay.
Why doesn't the metric depend on the field?
Why isn't what?
Why doesn't the metric depend on the field as well?
Okay, no. So you treat, you have, you know, a theory where you have several fields. One of the fields is the metric, is the gravitational field. The other fields are, I don't know, scalar field, electromagnetic field. So typically, you treat them as independent, right? So I'm just putting lots of fields in my space-time, and you treat them as independent quantities. All right, so that's our equation. Of course, if V is just m square phi square, you would get your favorite, you would get your favorite Klein-Gordon equation, but now in cat space. We would have lambda square minus m square acting on phi equals to zero, which is what you will see in your field theory course all the time. All right, so that's the field equation. So next you can calculate what the corresponding T mu nu is. So our action for the matter is just given by this integral d4 of x square root of g minus g, and then this Lagrangian here. All right. So then you need to know how to vary this with respect to the metric. So this L is here. So the only appearance of the metric is over here, right? And for that, all you need to know is the two key simple results which you already derived in your tutorial. So we need, so to do this, we need two beautiful small results, and so you derive them. So one of them is how you differentiate the determinant of the metric, and you derive that this is equal to minus 1/2 square root of minus g mu nu delta g mu nu. Okay, so that's the first result which you really need, and the second result is even simpler if I want to differentiate a metric which has indices down, then I can write it as a variation of something which has indices up. So g mu rho, g mu sigma, delta g rho sigma. Okay, so that's the two relations which you need to actually calculate basically anything you want. All right, so that's what you have derived in your tutorial. So very good. So if I want to vary now this with respect to the metric g, okay, so it's d4 of x, and then I first vary the Lagrangian density and leave the square root of the determinant untouched, and then I vary the square root of the determinant and leave L untouched. Okay. And that's what it is. All right, so if I vary with respect to the metric my Lagrangian density, well, the only appearance of the metric is here. So I just put a delta in front of it. So this thing here is just minus 1/2 nabla mu phi, nabla nu phi, delta g mu nu. Just put a delta here. And if I vary this thing here, I just use this formula over here. So then what you actually derive is that this is equal to minus 1/2 integral d4 of x square root of minus g. And so I'm putting this minus 1/2 here. It'll be nabla mu, nabla nu phi, nabla mu phi, nabla nu phi. And then if I look at this formula, it just gives me g mu nu at the bottom, and then leaves L invariant. So it's plus L times g mu nu delta g mu nu. Okay, so that's what you find when you vary that using this formula here. Aha, so that's all we have to do. Now we compare with our beautiful formula for the defining of T mu nu, and we read off that whatever is in the bracket is actually the T mu nu. So this is the T mu nu for the scalar field. And we know that, you know, our action is certainly a scalar, so we know it's diffeomorphism invariant, so we know that such T mu nu will be conserved. So now it's an exercise to show that the conservation of this T mu nu actually implies this equation.
Sorry.
I don't know if it was because I got here late, but how does the variation with respect to g of the Lagrangian work?
Oh, now I just look at the explicit explicit form of the Lagrangian, right? And as I see, where do I see the metric, right?
But the
so the only place where I see the metric is the first term. So I just put a delta in front of that G union.
Oh, because it's a scalar field. There are no Christoffel symbols.
There are no Christoffel symbols.
Yeah.
All right, so that's how it works for the scalar field. And so I leave that as an exercise. So exercise to show that lambda mu d mu nu equals to 0 for this should be equivalent to our box plus minus m square on phi equals to 0. Can you show that? I urge you to do it as an exercise while there is time, or otherwise you will do it for the first time in your interview. All right, very good. So we have that. So now the next example number two would be the electromagnetic field, LMAC field. So for the LMAC field, of course, you want to write down the Lagrangian density, which, let's say, in flat space is a Lorentz scalar. In this case, it's a general scalar. And of course, you want that this Lagrangian density depends on our field, and it depends on the derivatives of the field. But it doesn't depend on higher derivatives of that. So this is not possible, because we would have higher order equations of motion. So now you may be asking, you know, can I write an action which depends on the field, on the derivatives of the field, and that's it? And of course, what it would be nice is that if this action is gauge invariant. Okay, so plus gauge invariance. And so then you may be asking, you know, what are the possibilities here? And surprise, surprise, there's actually only very much limited possibilities how you can write what this action is. And so there's only basically two invariants you can construct out of the electromagnetic field. One invariant, so first you have to introduce the field strength, f mu nu. So in special relativity, it would be given by that. Okay, that would be true in special relativity. Now you might think, well, okay, so in general relativity, I have to replace my partial derivatives with the covariant ones. Okay. Okay, but I am not afraid to write an equality here, because these things actually are equal. So if you have the Christoffel connection, if you have Christoffel symbols, and you write this as a partial derivative plus gamma term, and this as a partial derivative plus gamma term, and use the fact that the Christoffel symbols are symmetric in the lower two indices, but there is an antisymmetrization of these because of the minus sign, this is actually equal. So you can do either this or that, both are correct. If you have Christoffel connection, if you are in general relativity. If you are not, there will be a torsion term, which makes it different. Anyway, so this is our field strength. And then once we have the field strength, you may try to construct some scalars out of this f mu nu. So one possible scalar would be f mu nu g mu nu. Is that a good scalar to consider?
No.
No, because? Because f mu nu is antisymmetric. And so that would be 0. So f mu nu, g mu nu is not a good scalar. So that doesn't work. So what you actually have to do is that you have to construct scalar which is quadratic in f mu nu. So one such scalar is this one. F is 1/4, why not? F mu nu. That's one scalar. It's something like e square minus b square. The other scalar, is there another scalar?
duals?
With the dual. It's actually one dual. If you have two duals, then this is basically that. Okay, so then the other scalar is 1/4 I naught f mu nu star f mu nu. Okay, so that's the other scalar. And there is nothing else which you can write down apart from these two scalars. And this is something like E times B. So of course, annoying thing is that for electromagnetic waves, both these scalars are zero. So E is perpendicular to B, so that's why this is zero. And actually E squared equals to B squared, the magnitude is the same. So that's why that is zero. So for electromagnetic fields, this is, for electromagnetic waves, both these scales are zero. But anyway, so now, so we have these possibilities. And so now our L electromagnetism, in principle, can be a function, any function of F and G. In fact, G, because of this Hodge dual there, it's not a complete scalar. It's almost a scalar. But it's not invariant under parity. So if you want invariance under parity as well, then you would put G squared here. But anyway, so this would be a general electromagnetic theory. So now if you want to specify to Maxwell's theory, you just take a special case of this. In fact, you take the simplest possible special case of that. You just take L equal to F. Okay, so for Maxwell, you just take LEM equals to F. So that's the simplest possible choice you can make. Of course, that's not the only choice, and people still consider, you know, other possibilities. So interesting possibilities is that when you actually introduce this g, and so you know, any function of f and g square, it still actually only contains first derivatives of a. So the resulting equations will be second order equations. But if I start putting f square and g square, whatever, they will be nonlinear. So you know, other choices correspond to nonlinear electromagnetisms. Other choices yield nonlinear electromagnetism. And so one special nice example is that of Born-Infeld theory, which you can read about in the appendix of the study text. So Born-Infeld theory is interesting theory because it was written down already at the beginning of 20th century. And so people thought this is a really interesting possibility for some reason. Then that reason went away. But anyway, 50 years later, people discovered the same theory by considering a different reason. So they were looking at, you know, all possible electromagnetic fields. And they said, well, Born-Infeld theory is the only one which actually has nice propagation of electromagnetic waves. So example would be here. Born-Infeld theory. So, and then, you know, this reason is interesting, but maybe not so much for physics. So then again, you know, the interest faded. And then people in the 80s, they realized Born-Infeld theory is precisely what couples to string in string theory. So actually, Born-Infeld electromagnetism is much more natural in string theory than the Maxwell electromagnetism. Okay, but then if you don't believe in string theory, well, okay, so who cares? But then in 2000s and onward, actually people realized that Born-Infeld type actions actually are important for cosmology. And so actually people consider Born-Infeld types of action for inflation and stuff like that. Okay, so this theory is like, you know, a phoenix, and it rises from the ashes every 20 years or something like that. Okay, so every 20 years. So now I think it's the time for it to actually rise again. So let's see. Of course, the problem is that the action is very complicated, and the field equations are very complicated. Let me just write it down for you. So that would be L Bornfeld would be something like, well, there's some parameter B, which is not important, but then there's 1 plus 2F over B squared plus minus G squared over B to the 4, and then minus 1. So now, if the fields are weak, so this term goes away for sure, and this term just gives you, so if you look at this and compare with Maxwell theory, if the fields are weak, it actually reduces to electromagnetic field. If F is small, I can do a Taylor expansion, and I just get F back. Okay, so that's the theory, and you may read about it in the appendix. Anyway, so we have electromagnetic action now, and of course, in curve space, this is equally true. So when we are in curve space, our L electromagnetism is just this 1/4 F mu nu. But what it means is that I have to write it in terms of the curve metric. So it will be 1/4 F mu nu F rho sigma. And then I have to contract the two indices. So it will be G mu rho, G nu, and sigma. And that's how your electromagnetic field in curve space, electromagnetic action, looks like. Okay, so for Maxwell. Okay, and so if you vary this with respect to the field A mu, so the variation with respect to A mu gives you the field equations, which are the Maxwell equations. So now the Maxwell equations in curve space, they look like this. Well, this is without the sources. Okay. Okay, let me write them with sources. F mu nu, so then it's minus 4 pi j nu. If you had sources, of course, then I have to add the interaction between the Maxwell field, and so it will be minus j nu a nu. So that's how I add sources. Anyway, so this is the Maxwell equation. Of course, the other Maxwell equation is automatically satisfied because I constructed my F mu nu from the potential A mu. So that guarantees that the other Maxwell equation is satisfied. So basically, the only change from flat space is that you again replace partial derivative with the covariant one. Okay. Now you will see in your tutorial, I think maybe today, is that there's another way how you can write this divergence of F mu nu. And so there's a beautiful formula that you can change this covariant derivative into a partial one. Minus F mu nu mu minus 4 pi j nu. Okay, so this is how you can write down the covariant derivative in terms of just the square root of the determinant and the partial derivative here. Okay, and so that's only true because F mu nu is antisymmetric in the two indices. But then, basically, I don't really have to calculate covariant derivatives. I don't need to calculate the Christoffel symbols. I just need to calculate the determinant of the metric. And that's the formula you are using in your homework, hopefully. Right? All right, so that's that. So by the way, you might think that, you know, this principle replacing partial derivative is the covariant one, and eta with g works all the time. Well, it's not quite so. So you know that the special relativistic law, so I can write down the Maxwell equation in terms of the potential as well. Right? So you can write something like, so note that in special relativity, I can also write it as d mu a nu minus 4 pi j nu, so boson a nu is just j nu, and d mu a mu equals to 0. That's also Maxwell equations, right? So now you might think, okay, so if I want this to be in curve space, I just replace the partial derivatives with the covariant ones. In particular, you might think that this is true. Napla mu, Napla mu, a nu is minus 4 pi j nu. Okay? So you might think that this will actually do the trick, but it's not true. Okay, so this is not true. And there will be a correction. So this is not true. Instead, the right equation is this one. And then I don't know the sign, but let's write plus minus r nu alpha a alpha plus to minus 4 pi j nu. Okay, so that will be a Ricci scalar, a Ricci tensor acting on my potential, and this is the correct equation. Of course, both of these equations correctly reduce to this one in the flat space limit, but you know, to guess that there is this curvature term here, it's not trivial, right? So not always it's enough to replace partial derivatives with the covariant ones. Sometimes you can pick up terms which are, for example, given by the curvature term. Okay, so the final thing is that, of course, you can vary this action, the corresponding action, with respect to the metric to get the corresponding t mu nu. And so there will be an exercise. Another exercise is that if I do delta g of this action, of course, I now forget about sources. I just vary this part of the action. I just vary this g, that g, and the square root of g. Okay, so then you get the corresponding t mu nu, which is the nice and right one. So t mu nu is 1 over 4 pi f mu alpha f mu alpha minus 1 quarter g mu nu f alpha beta, okay? So that's your t mu nu for the electromagnetic field, which you get by varying this action with respect to the metric. And again, you may see what happens if I apply Nabla mu on this. Do I actually get the field equations? So certainly, if the field equations are satisfied, Nabla mu f mu nu equals to 0, you can show that this is conserved. The question is if this is conserved, do I get the Maxwell equation Nabla mu f mu nu equals to 0? Try it, and you will see.
Where do you get the 1 over 4 pi in the t mu nu?
1 over 4 pi.
I don't think you'll get it because.
There's no. Yeah, okay.
There's no pi.
There's no pi here. So, what is the right action?
I think it's it. Just
So, what I'm writing in the notes is correct. So, I'm putting 1. Okay. Everything is wrong. So, I'm writing minus. let's write it this way. This is minus 4 pi. Okay, so I should be dividing by 1 over 4 pi in addition to this. And yeah. Anyway, so that's where the pi comes from. Thank you for that question. Making me look really stupid. Oh, that's fine. Questions? Okay, so let's discuss one last example of t mu nu, and that is the t mu nu of the perfect fluid. Of course, t mu nu of the perfect fluid is very important for cosmology, because that's basically what you will do the whole cosmology course, is that you will discuss consequences of having a perfect fluid filling our universe. But let me, this is super useful for cosmology first. It's super useful for interiors of stars, where you basically say, I describe my interior of the star as perfect fluid. So if you want to really discuss relativistic stars, that's what you need to do. There'll be a nice technical thing is that I will introduce projectors along a curve and to a space perpendicular to a curve. And then we will see another example of what it means that Nabla mu t mu nu equals to 0 actually gives you the equation of motion. Okay, so example number 3 is that of perfect fluid. Example 3, perfect fluid. Uh, And so let me just write down the T mu nu. It's coming out of nowhere, but it is. So it's given by rho plus p times u mu u nu plus p g mu nu. That's how the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid looks like. Okay, so now u mu, of course, is the forward velocity of the fluid. U mu is the velocity, forward velocity of the fluid. And rho is the energy density of the fluid, and p is the pressure of the fluid, as seen by the observer who is co-moving with the fluid. Okay, so rho and p, rho is the energy density. Density and p is the pressure. It's as measured by an observer who is co-moving with the fluid. Observer co-moving with the fluid. So, you know, have a water flowing in your toilet, and so if you are moving with that water, you see around yourself certain energy density and certain pressure. And it's ugly, but that's what it is, right? Of course, if you are not moving with the fluid, you can see a different density and you can see a different pressure, right? So if you are moving against the water, there will be a pressure, anisotropic pressure, and so it will be more pressure against your motion than behind you. But if you are moving with that, and the perfect fluid means that the pressure is everywhere isotropic, and it's simply given by this p here. All right, so that's the T mu nu. So now we are interested in what happens when we apply nabla mu. So what do we get from 0 equals 2 nabla mu T mu nu?
We don't have a Lagrangian for this.
Aha. No. Okay, now so this is a very good question. So can you find a Lagrangian for this? This is not a really perfect fluid. It's not a fundamental theory. So I think you can maybe write down some Lagrangian, but it's not a fundamental Lagrangian. It's something which... So typically you get this by a derivative expansion in the fluid velocity and stuff like that. And so people are typically happy with the T mu nu and not trying to write down the Lagrangian.
If I use a scalar field, can I relate the scalar field with the forward velocity of a perfect fluid somehow?
Ah, very good, yes. Yes. Yeah, so for example, when you will be discussing inflation in the early universe, you will actually realize that so inflation is driven by the scalar field. And so if you associate nabla of phi, so nabla mu of phi is u mu, then actually the corresponding is like a perfect fluid thing. So even scalar field can be written in this perfect fluid form. And you will do it in cosmology. So this is really all you need to understand cosmology. Okay, so this is that. All right, so what do we get? So we have nabla mu t mu nu, so let's write it explicitly down. Okay, so we have many terms. So we first have to differentiate this guy with respect to mu. So it will be rho plus p. But of course, I'm acting on a scalar, so it's just a partial derivative, mu, and then u mu u nu. U nu, so that's the first term. Then I have to differentiate this guy. So it's plus rho plus p. And then it's nabla mu u mu. And then u nu. Then I differentiate the last guy, rho plus p, u mu, nabla mu, u nu. Then I differentiate the pressure term. So it's plus p mu, g mu nu, plus I differentiate metric. Do I get anything? No, so plus zero. Okay, so that's how the conservation looks like. Well, it's a horrible mess. It's a long equation. So now what is useful is to introduce these projectors. Okay, so we have the fluid, which is flowing somewhere. Okay, so this is our four velocity of the fluid. Well, this is the gamma. This is the four velocity of the fluid. So now what you can do is that you can actually project anything. So if you have, if you are given a vector field u mu in your spacetime, of course this is true everywhere. If I have another line for my fluid, another line for my fluid, and so on. So you can always, at any point, you can basically split your spacetime into the space which is along your curve and to a space which is perpendicular to a curve. Okay, so then we will have a perpendicular space here. And then, so this will be a perpendicular space, and this space will be the parallel space with my four velocity. Okay, so I have a perpendicular space over here. Perpendicular space, like that. And then I have a space which goes along the four velocity along the fluid. So now the statement is, we can find a projector to this space and project it to that space. And the way you do it is that you write an identity, delta alpha beta, as a projector to one space plus a projector to another space. Okay, so the projectors are better orthogonal. So really, I can either project into this space or project into that space. And if I project into both, I have to get an identity. So this is the projector into the perpendicular space. And this is the projector into the parallel space. OK, so now that I am not lying to you, let's see that these are really projectors. So what is the property of a projector?
P squared equals P.
Exactly. So if I apply the projector twice, the second time I'm applying it doesn't do anything. Okay. So the first check. So we can check. Check that H alpha beta H beta gamma is just H alpha gamma. Okay. Of course, you know what I'm assuming is that my four velocity is actually normalized. So you always assume that u squared is minus one, right? It's minus one. That's what you need to show that this is true. So similarly, you could show that this projector here, u alpha u beta, if you apply it twice, you get the same projector there as well. So now another nice property would be that really this projects into space which is perpendicular to that. So let's apply the projector H alpha beta onto our four velocity U beta. Okay. So what is this? So it better be equal to zero, because if this projects into perpendicular space, but this is only in the parallel space, so this better be equal to zero. So is it? So now H alpha beta, so what is it? It's delta alpha beta. It's delta alpha beta plus u alpha u beta acting on u beta. Okay, so this is just u alpha, and then I have u alpha, and then u beta, so it's minus one, so it's minus u alpha, so it is zero. So indeed, this thing is a projector because it satisfies this. Just do it yourself. And then it indeed projects to something which is perpendicular to my four velocity. All right, so now why are we doing this? So this is a very general technique. So you can either project along a curve or into a space perpendicular to the curve. Okay, and so this is how you do it. You have one projector and you have the second projector. So now let's apply these projectors onto our equation. So we have the equation nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero. So let's just look at separately its perpendicular part and its parallel part. Okay. So the perpendicular part is more interesting. So let's do it first. So the perpendicular part of nabla mu, t mu nu equals to zero is what? Okay, so what, how do we do that? Is that we apply this projector as so. So we know that it's zero and it's h alpha nu nabla mu t mu nu. Okay, so that's how we project the remaining index of the equation. All right, so now we have to take term by term and see what happens. Okay, so first we are doing h alpha nu on the first term. What do I get? I'm doing h alpha nu on the first term, which is rho plus p mu, u mu, u nu. I'm acting with h alpha nu. It's zero because it hits the u nu term. Okay, so this is zero. The first time is zero because I hit the u nu term. What happens with the second term? It's also zero because I also hit the u nu term. So it's plus zero. That's why the projection is super useful. Okay, so then I have a term, rho plus p. Rho plus p u mu nabla mu u nu, and then I have whatever h alpha nu here. Okay, and then I have a term plus h alpha nu p mu g mu nu, and that's equal to zero. Okay, so now we can simplify this a little bit by using again the delta thing. So we can say that this is delta alpha nu plus u alpha u nu. Okay, so we can just write it here. So now let's concentrate on the second one. So we have u alpha u nu acting on nabla mu u nu. So we will have a term which looks like u nu nabla mu and then u nu. You know what is this equal to?
Zero.
Sorry?
Zero.
It's equal to zero. Everybody sees why?
Because
this is something like 1/2, is it? Nabla mu u square. Right, but u square is minus one, so if I differentiate minus one, I get zero. So this is zero. Okay, but I see precisely that term here. So I have u nu, nabla mu, u nu here. So this term does not contribute. Okay, so the only term which does contribute is the first delta here. So I will have an equation rho plus p, u mu, nabla mu, and then I'm changing the index alpha, the index nu to index alpha, so it's u alpha. Okay, so that's the first term. And then the second term is plus h alpha nu p mu g mu nu, and that's equal to zero. Yes?
Nothing.
Okay, you are happy. So we are done. So what you actually see here, I can put one thing on the left hand side so that it looks more familiar to you. So what is here? It's rho plus p And then this is just a derivative with respect to u, or I can write it as d over d u alpha over d tau. That's what's written here, right? So d over alpha d tau, where tau is the parameter which parametrizes my curve. Okay, and this is equal to, oh, that'll be a minus. And then let's see. So what is this here? So it's just a gradient of p. So now with index up, but but this thing, what it does is that it projects that gradient of p into a perpendicular space to my motion. Okay, so this is just written as minus gradient alpha of p, but there will be a perpendicular trajectory here. All right, anybody recognizes this equation? Exactly. So if you take any fluid mechanics, this is a Navier-Stokes equation, basically. So if you open Wikipedia, and so this is a relativistic generalization, relativistic Navier-Stokes equation. Of course, okay. So if you open Wikipedia, what you will find is that the Navier-Stokes equation, as you know it, is just rho d three-dimensional velocity dt equals to minus gradient of pressure plus other terms if you go beyond a perfect fluid. So for example, if you have viscosity and if you have other terms, then you would have them here. But anyway, so this is what you will find. The Navier-Stokes equation looks like in the non-relativistic way. So now you see that, okay, the perpendicular thing makes sense. The only thing which is suspicious here in this equation is the appearance of the pressure here, right? So otherwise it would look the same. And if I take the three-dimensional part of this, then the perpendicular actually doesn't really matter. But this thing is different. So now if you restore the units of C, what you would actually find is that this thing is written as p over c square. Okay, so the pressure term actually indeed is suppressed in the non-relativistic limit because this term would actually go to zero, and then you precisely recover the Navier-Stokes equation.
Sorry, I don't get why the orthogonal perpendicular components make sense.
No. Okay, so what you in order to restore that one, I have to write out the 3D part. Okay, so what this projector does is basically it acts as a unity in the three-dimensional part. What it does, it removes the time velocity. So if I use coordinates where my u is 1, 0, 0, 0, then the projector just kills everything which has the time component, but leaves everything else untouched. So that's why you recover that equation. So this thing really does something in the time direction, in the other directions. So, yeah, so that's why it would recover that. But now you see that, you know, this term is present in the relativistic case. It's not present in the non-relativistic case. But what it actually means is that it makes lots of difference because it basically tells you the pressure contributes to the energy density which gravitates. Okay, so now if you studied, I don't know, stars, if you taken any course on stars, then you know that the star is a ball. Which gravitates down, so there's a gravity force down. And of course, in order this not to collapse, I have to provide a gradient of pressure going up there. So basically, I balance the pressure with the gravitational force, and that's how I form an equilibrium star. Okay, so now, however, more pressure I provide, actually, the pressure contributes to the energy density, which self-gravitates. Okay, so actually, the relativistic stars have really hard life because they think, okay, if I start collapsing, I can increase the pressure. But in fact, if I increase the pressure, I start self-gravitating more, and so I start collapsing more. So relativistic stars have really hard life. Because of this p over c squared term. which means that the pressure gravitates. So, gravitates. Okay, so, oh no. All right. So, that's what we learned from this perpendicular part of the equation. Of course, what remains to be seen, what is the parallel part? So in order to find the parallel part, I should be multiplying by this projector u alpha u beta. But in fact, you know, you see that this projector decomposes into something which is interesting, which is the u beta part, and something which is not interesting is the u alpha part. Okay, so what I actually have to do is that I can just multiply the equation by u nu, and that's it, right? So the parallel part. So now the parallel part. And so what I do is that I take, I have 0 equals to u nu nabla mu t mu nu. Okay. So that will still be true. And I'm just using the projector. I would have u alpha here, but that u alpha will not do anything interesting. All right. So let's see what remains out of our equation. So what about the first term? So now we have to do it again. So we have rho plus p mu, u mu, u nu. So what happens when we multiply this by u nu? Exactly. So we will have u nu, u nu, u nu, which gives us minus 1. So there will be minus rho plus p mu, and then u mu, right? So that's the first term. The second term, well, basically the same thing happens. You have u nu squared there, so it's minus rho plus p nabla mu u mu, and then u nu squared is minus 1, so that's the minus here. What happens is the third term. So then we will have u nu nabla mu u nu, which is 0 because it's just, okay, so it's plus 0. And what happens is the last term?
U mu d mu p.
So it is there, right? So then we have plus u nu p mu g mu nu. Okay, but of course this is nothing else than p mu u mu, right? P mu u mu. So now look at the beauty. So we have this term here, but we have the same term here with a minus sign. So this guy cancels that guy. And so we have an equation at 0. Okay, so let's put this guy on the left-hand side. So then we have rho mu u mu equals to, okay, and that one as well, rho plus p nabla mu u mu equals to 0. Or this is just the rho d rho over d tau plus rho plus p nabla mu u mu equals to 0. Anybody recognizes this equation? Exactly. So what you can do is that, of course, I can absorb this thing here into that. But anyway, in either form, you can write it either in this form if you like it. I like this form. But you can also write it in another form, which would be nabla mu of u mu rho plus p equals to d p over d tau. Okay, that's another form which you could write it. So if the right-hand side is zero, well, then I have a continuity equation. Okay, but of course we know that in the non-relativistic limit, p is suppressed by over c squared. So this thing is actually zero, this thing is zero, and then I have a divergence of u times rho is equal to zero, which is precisely the continuity equation. So compared to the standard continuity equation, which is d rho over dt plus divergence of rho v is to zero. So this is a relativistic generalization of the continuity equation.
But then does this mean that we don't have conservation of the fluid? I mean, because the continuity equation was not a relativist, like it was really the conservation of mass, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it must be still. Well, I think. That's right, yeah, it must be the conservation of the energy or the fluid or whatever. But anyway, so this is the special relativistic form, or general relativistic form, the continuity equation. If I integrate this over, that's a good question. Let me think about it. But anyway, so you see that, you know, really the equation, so we start this perfect fluid, and we just impose the conservation of the energy momentum tensor, nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero, and we are actually getting out of that both. We are getting the equations of motion for the fluid, which are the Navier-Stokes equations, but of course we are also getting the constraint on which is in terms of the continuity equation.
I think mass is not conserved in the relativity, in the general relativity.
Yeah, it doesn't look like, right?
Yeah, because the energy is given to the metric, to the g mu nu.
Oh, because mass is energy.
Yeah.
God.
Oh, thank you.
That's cool.
Very good. So we have this. So in other words, really, this should again convince you that nabla mu d mu nu equals to zero is different from just the conservation of energy. It's more like a field equation. Equation for the matter. Okay, I hope this convinced you. But also, now you know what your cosmology course will be about. And now you know why actually relativistic stars have hard life as well. All right. So chapter section D, are there any questions to this? Everything is clear and nice. So now part D will be the Einstein-Hilbert action. So of course Einstein has nothing to do with it. It was Hilbert who wrote it. But anyway, so we want to write now the Lagrangian density for the gravitational field itself. Okay, so we would like to find Lagrangian density. It should be a Lagrangian density, which depends on the metric, the derivatives of the metric, and that's it. So that we are guaranteed the second order equations of motion in the derivatives of the metric. And so we are looking for a scalar, which should look like this. Can we write such a scalar? What do you think? So is there something like an equivalence principle here coming in? So equivalence principle tells me I can write this as flat metric and I can vanish that. So such an action is not good, right? So actually there is no such scale. There is no such scalar. Scalar. And you can think about the equivalence principle. Oh, there is a scalar, G minus. G minus square or whatever. But that's not really, it doesn't have any derivatives, so it will not give me second order differential equations for my G. Okay, so this seems like a big problem, right? So that's what I need. I need the Lagrangian density, which depends only on the on the first derivatives of the metric. But I cannot find one. Okay, so what you have to do, the next step is, well, let's consider a Lagrangian density, which depends on two derivatives of the metric. So let's just try to find a scalar, which depends on up to two derivatives of the metric. And let's pray that this gives us the right equations. Okay, so then let's go to second derivatives of the metric. And then, do you know any scalar which depends on metric, first derivative of the metric, and second derivative of the metric?
The Ricci.
It's the Ricci scalar. Right, so then we have a nice and simple choice. Simple choice, which is the Ricci scalar. Okay, hence, we arrived and we derived, basically, the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, so the Einstein-Hilbert as Einstein-Hilbert action, which depends on the metric, is given by, so let me put these numbers there. So it's 1 over 16 pi g. Why not? And then an integral d4 of x square root of minus g, and then the Ricci scalar, which depends on the metric and the first derivatives of the metric and the second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so that's the simplest possible choice you can make. There is no any choice which would have only one derivative of the metric. So you have to go to two derivatives of the metric. And one such scalar, which is nice, is this one here. Okay. So that's what Hilbert tried. And so let's vary this action with respect to the metric now. Okay, so that should give us the field equations for the metric. Right? So now we do the variation with respect to the metric. But there is a very useful dirty trick. We know that the Ricci scalar is actually written in terms of the Ricci tensor times the metric. We know, but the trick is that the Ricci scalar is written as R mu nu times G mu nu. Okay, so that's not really the trick, that's the definition of the Ricci scalar. But that's the most important thing which you have to realize when you want to vary this action. Okay, so if we vary this action, well, we have 1 over 16 pi G. Okay, so let's write 16 pi G delta of Einstein-Hilbert, 65 g delta s of Einstein-Hilbert. And so that's given by three terms. An integral d4 of x, so we vary the square root of g, and then we leave the Ricci scalar untouched. The second term is that we vary the metric g here, and leave Ricci and the square root of g untouched. That's plus square root of g r mu nu delta g mu nu. That's the second term. And finally, I have to vary the Ricci tensor here. So it's plus square root of minus g g mu nu delta r mu nu. That's the three terms I have to do. All right. So the second term, I am done, right? So the second term, there is nothing else to vary. So this is already will be fine. So this I don't have to do any work. The first term, I have to do a little bit of work. Namely, I have to find my beautiful formula, which probably disappeared. Is it gone? It's gone, unfortunately. So you need to know how to vary the square root of determinant. So we know that this is given by minus 1 half square root of g g mu nu delta g mu nu. And so you see that I am getting that this is equal to d4 of x square root of minus g. And then this term just gives me r mu nu, r mu nu. And this term gives me minus 1 half r g mu nu, delta g mu nu. Plus, unfortunately, the last term, plus d4 of x square root of minus g, g mu nu, delta r mu nu. But bloody hell, we already know the result, right? We already know that, that this is a definition of our Einstein tensor, right? If we have no matter, we require that the Einstein tensor is equal to zero. Okay, so the last term better not contribute anything, because if it did, we screw up our intuition and whatever, right? So the statement is this is precisely right. So this indeed is the Einstein equation g mu equals to zero, which comes from the variation of the first two terms. The second term you can show is just a boundary term. Okay. So now you can show that this thing here actually can be written as a total divergence of some vector v mu. And so hence, I can apply the Stokes theorem, and this just gives us the boundary term. And as such, I throw away the boundary term. Okay, and then I recover beautiful Einstein equation, g mu nu equals to zero. Okay, so that's the Einstein equation in vacuum. So now, maybe thinking, okay, so that's perfect. I can write this as nabla mu v mu. So let's look at what this v mu is. Okay, so the v mu, after very long calculation, Sewald or later course on gravitational physics, where you will do it, is that you'll find that v mu actually is written as this thing here. It's nabla beta delta g mu beta minus g alpha beta nabla mu delta g alpha beta. Okay, so this is what it is. But now, okay, so we thrown that away, the term, but the horror comes now, right? This is horrifying. So you see that you have a total derivative of something, but that something actually depends on the derivative of the variations of the metric. Okay? So in fact, so what you would need to do is that actually you need not only to prescribe that the variation of the metric on the boundary is zero, so that we could integrate by parts. But we also need to prescribe the normal derivatives of the variations of the metric on the boundary to be equal to zero. Okay, which I cannot do. Right? Of course, you cannot do that. So it's the same thing as we were discussing in the classical physics. Whatever, you cannot prescribe that your variational points are fixed, but also the velocities are fixed there. You cannot do that. You would have too many boundary conditions. And so you have a boundary term, but that actually does not vanish. Okay? And so what it means is that, in fact, the Einstein-Hilbert action gives you the right equations of motion, gives you the Einstein equations, but it's an ill post variational principle, because you get a boundary term which you cannot kill. Okay, so Einstein-Hilbert action is super fast in finding the Einstein equations, but it is ill post.
So we shouldn't take it as more than just a mnemonic device to obtain the equations of motion.
Okay, so So now you have to think about what's happening, right? So why is this happening? And can we fix it? So one way to fix it is that you say, well, I don't care what's happening with the boundary term. I just need to throw it away, so I will throw it away by hand. And I have the right equations, right? The other way is to see, well, can I actually maybe upgrade my action so that I don't get these unpleasant boundary terms which have the normal derivatives of the metric on the boundary. And so you need to, basically the simplest way is that you add a boundary term which kills these unwanted boundary terms. And so the so now this term which you have to add is called Gibbons-Hawking term. Okay.
What's the name of it?
So this is ill-posed. Ill-posed because I have, so on boundary, cannot impose both. Delta G and on the boundary is equal to zero, and that delta of dg on the boundary is equal to zero. So you cannot do that. But what you can do is that you can add, can upgrade the action by adding a boundary term which cancels precisely this. By adding boundary term which cancels this, which cancels these terms, which cancels delta dg on the boundary. So the corresponding boundary term is called Gibbons-Hawking term. So Cambridge professors so they found this term in case of the space-like or time-like boundary. Okay, so and then it was not realized until, I don't know, 2 years ago. It actually would be nice to have also corresponding boundary term for the null boundary. It's related to holographic complexity, and then people actually have to calculate the action for null surfaces. Then they also need this Gibbons-Hawking term for null surfaces. And so people like Rob Myers and Eric Poisson and Raphael Sorkin have a paper 2 years ago where they actually generalize this to the null surfaces. Okay. And of course, the motivation was that some people actually did ignore the boundary terms for the holographic complexity. They got some result, but they were of course not right to ignore these terms. So now Rob and the others, they actually devoted lots of time to find the corresponding boundary term. And then they did the calculation. Of course, the previous people were right. And so they were right to neglect the thing. So it took a couple of months to actually just verify what was already known. But anyway, okay, so that's the Gibbons-Hawking term. And you will see what it is maybe at the end of this course, if I have time, but certainly in the gravitational physics course. You will see the derivation here. All right, so we have a variational principle for the Einstein equations. It's ill-posed, but it can be upgraded, and this is our equations. So let me just tell you that so we are in vacuum, right? So we are in vacuum so far. And so our g mu is r mu minus 1/2 r g mu. What we can do is that we can contract this equation with the metric. Okay, so by multiplying with small g mu nu by metric, we get, and so this is equal to zero, we get, if I contract this metric, this thing, I get just r. And this thing here, I have 1/2 r, and then I have g mu nu, g mu nu. Do you know what g mu nu is in d dimensions?
D.
D. Okay, so it's d. So you're finding that it's 1 minus d over 2 times r. But of course, that's equal to zero. So if you are not in two dimensions, and people are obsessed with two dimensions recently, so if d is not equal to 2, Then you conclude that the Ricci scale has to be equal to zero as well in vacuum. But if now I plug it back here, I conclude that in vacuum, my Einstein equations are just R mu nu equals to zero. So these are the Einstein equations in vacuum. And you can write them equally as R mu nu equals to zero or as G mu nu equals to zero. It doesn't matter as long as you are not in two dimensions. Okay, so let me stop here. And then we continue discussing Einstein equations and adding matter and stuff like that tomorrow.